The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest hashtag no filter edition. It's Wednesday, August 30th, 2017. On today's show, the indie movie Ingrid Goes West. It's a chilling social media satire starring Aubrey Plaza as the sadly demented fan of an Instagram star who's played by Elizabeth Olsen. And then Rick and Morty is a wild and kooky cartoon jaunt on the Cartoon Network. It's part of the Adult Swim franchise, and my daughter loves it, for what it's worth. And finally, Slate's own Aisha Harris goes on an ethnographic exploration of, yes, it's true, Dolly Parton's Dixie Stampede, a themed restaurant. We're joined by Isaac Butler. Isaac, when I think of themed restaurants, I don't think of you.
No. Sorry. Your first question is always so disarming, Stephen.
It's the banter ball that can't be hit back.
I know. It's so specialty. Good. It's just like, shoo, that was like a 134 mile per hour ace. Can we try that again?
No. This all stays.
This all stays? That's great.
Rainforest Cafe, buddy, go.
Yeah. The last theme restaurant I was at was like a Henry VIII themed thing in Virginia Beach, Virginia, when I was 12 years old. And
see, I knew this would be good.
Yeah, a friend of my older sister's played like the court jester, and I think I ate a turkey leg.
I love it. Isaac Butler, I should say, in addition to being a major, major fop friend of the program, is a writer and Slate contributor and co-author of The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, which I'm excited to say you can now pre-order on Amazon. He co-authored it with Dan Coyce. No idea who that guy is. And we're joined by Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey there, Stephen.
Should I throw a 130 mile per hour fastball at you?
Sure, flatten me out.
That was your 130 mile per hour fastball. I've got nothing, but I am excited to talk about these topics. Let's plunge in. All right. Well, Ingrid Goes West. It was a darling at the Sundance Film Festival. It stars Aubrey Plaza as Ingrid, a young and very depressed woman whose life lights up only vicariously, especially when she feels included in something that's happening within the glow of social media. She becomes obsessed with a Los Angeles lifestyle guru and moves single white female style to Los Angeles to befriend her. The movie also stars, and this is a shout out that has to happen right up top, O'Shea Jackson. He's terrific as her landlord and possible love interest. The movie was co-written and directed by Matt Spicer. Let's listen to a clip.
What's your biggest emotional wound?
What?
It's our question of the day.
Oh.
Mine's actually my relationship with my dad.
I'm good, thanks.
All right. Well, in that case, welcome to Grateful Kitchen. My name's Eden. How can I nourish you today?
You know, I'm actually meeting a friend for lunch here. Have you seen her?
Oh, yeah, Taylor Sloan. Yeah. She comes in all the time.
I know.
She was actually here like an hour ago. You said you're meeting her for lunch, or?
Oh, God, I must have gotten the time wrong. So stupid. Do you remember what she ordered?
Dana, let me start with you. What'd you make of this movie?
Oh, boy, I have so much to say. I'm excited to talk about this movie with you guys. So this movie, to me, okay, it's the director's debut film. So given that, I didn't know that going in, given that he's writing and directing a movie for the first time, this is a pretty impressive single, first base single, maybe. But to me, the setup was so much better than the payoff. And I don't want to spoil majorly. We can get into maybe some spoilers later. But I really was excited about this movie for the first 30 or 40 minutes, maybe, in which the situation that you just described is set up, the way social media is satirized. There's a really great montage early on of Taylor Sloan, this as you call her, lifestyle guru. Basically, she's an Instagram brand influencer or something. That's how she makes a living. So she's this attractive young woman who goes around posing with brands and tagging them in her Instagram posts and making a living off of it. That in itself is fascinating. That such a thing exists is fascinating. Satirizing it is a great idea. The montage of her Instagram posts is hilarious. But I didn't think that this movie, I thought it spiraled down really hard in the last half. And we can kind of get into the reasons why. I think one of them has to do with this whole unlikable anti-hero, anti-heroine trope that is just really, really hard to handle, right? I mean, to have someone as hard to take as the Aubrey Plaza character Ingrid in this movie, you've got to have a lot of levels of kind of heart and intelligence and satire going on to keep them from simply being so either so off-putting that you want to stop watching the movie or that the villains and the heroes seem to be indistinguishable from one another. I just felt that the sharpness of the satire sort of disappeared. And although I agree with you that O'Shea Jackson is great as the landlord who also becomes Ingrid's love interest, his character makes no sense at all. Mm-hmm. And he puts up with so much shit from this woman that, to me, I started to lose respect for him as a character and for their relationship. So the ending, which I won't spoil, seemed really bifurcated to me, that it was trying to keep up that almost Black Mirror level of, you know, anxiety and terror about social media and technology and what it's done to our lives and our souls, and also to have some sort of gesture toward a romantic happy ending. And so I didn't get that. I'm a little bit allergic, I think, to Aubrey Plaza, and I don't quite know why. I mean, she's really good at what she does, and God knows I like a sarcastic, drop-dead, cool female heroine, but I've never liked her in a movie. I know that in Parks and Rec she was supposed to be all that, and I can see her appeal, but she doesn't really carry this movie for me. There's something inert at the heart of it.
Isaac, what do you think?
I think I both agree with Dana's criticisms and was a little more taken with it. I think there is a specificity to it and to its satire that's really right on, and I think the way that it's like Grateful Kitchen, which is a satire. There's a real LA vegan restaurant called Cafe Gratitude that it's only slightly exaggerated. You get to Grateful Kitchen. The Integratron is a real place where you take these sound wave baths out in Joshua Tree. And so I thought that there was a specificity to it. And there's a lot of like really clever stuff, like O'Shea Jackson's character, who's the ultimate do-gooder. He's Batman, right? And that's why he's such a sap. He's positioned as Batman.
Because he's writing a Batman script on spec and is obsessed with Batman.
Yeah, exactly.
Specifically the Joel Schumacher Batman.
Exactly. And then Taylor's brother is the Joker, and he's dating a woman named Harley, right? So there's like these very clever references seated throughout it. And I thought this idea of what happens when you commodify everything in your life and then you turn those things into the images of themselves was really fascinating. However, I just think it needed to go further in any of its directions, as opposed to kind of looping back on itself with the kind of Twilight Zone-y, Black Mirror-y, but yet kind of happy, like a darkly happy ending, right? Like there's a, know, it'll surprise no one that Taylor's life is not as happy and well put together as it seems on Instagram. And the movie starts exploring that and then immediately veers away from it.
Right, exactly.
In this kind of weird second plot in the second half of the movie. And if it had just gone further into that, if it had embraced the kind of Tom Ripley aspects of Ingrid's character, I think it would have been a lot stronger. But I will say, I mean, there's some moments in it that will stick with me. There's one that's in the trailer where they're singing in the car, where she and Taylor are singing in the van, and Aubrey Plaza, like her obsession sort of comes in that section and then moves away, so that they're just two women having fun. And then, you know, like,
but she kind of can't keep her eyes on the road because she's so obsessed with her idol.
And sequences like that were so, I thought, impressive and well modulated and put together, that I'm really looking forward to what the director does
absolutely.
Next.
Oh, absolutely. It's grippingly well directed, if nothing else. I actually thought the performances were terrific through and through. I loved Wyatt Russell, who's terrific as the kind of, you know, adjunct, stoogey adjunct husband to this woman's, you know, perfectly curated life. He's great. I thought, oddly enough, this, what's the name of the great Nicole Kidman movie, satire written by Joyce Maynard with
To Die For?
To Die For. I thought that was, so that was one possible, you know, it definitely hits a fork, right? It's either gonna humanize or dehumanize this poor woman. The problem with the To Die For fork is that this is a movie, to the extent that you humanize this movie, humanize the character and therefore the movie, it's a movie about mental illness. I mean, she is a deeply sick young woman, and the movie's in control of that and understands that. And I don't think that we're, you know, 20 years or whatever it is after Single White Female, we're not in the same place as a society about mental illness, and utterly demonizing someone who needs help. It just isn't acceptable. So the sort of the satisfyingly generic direction to go in is deeply insulting to her as a person who's sick and needs help. the humanist way kind of undoes the power of the satire of the first half. And so it kind of didn't take the fork. It kind of bounced into the crux of it and off of it, which is why the second half of the film doesn't quite work. That said, I do want to emphasize it is sharply, sharply written for how broad the satire could be. It is very finely observed, and the directing is confident and totally in control. But
I would say it is intermittently under control and intermittently well written. But I completely agree with you, Steve, about whatever that metaphor was about bouncing off the fork. The moment that sympathy towards a woman who's mentally ill and satire of the social media universe that she and her friends are trapped in, the way that those two things fail to braid together in the second half or last two thirds of the movie is my big criticism of it.
Yeah, and to me, I think the I don't know if this is the solution or whatever, but the to me, the stronger choice, because it sort of tries to have it both ways in the second half, is to
with the romance.
Yeah, is to instead go fully misanthropic with Elizabeth Olsen's character and her life. It's actually to suck the humanity out of that, I think, as much as it is about imbuing Ingrid with humanity. Like there's a thing where it's about to look at this phenomenon in society and essentially say, you know, there's an illness here as well, not a DSM-5R illness, but an illness here as well. And then it just veers away from it.
Brilliant, yeah.
It also sort of fails to veer down one of the most interesting avenues it could have gone down, which is the economic underpinning of the Instagrammer's life, right?
Yeah, it plays that lightly, right? It's like, you don't know, she says, oh, brands pay me. You know, none of those things are hashtagged as ads, of course, which they're, you know, more ethical people do if they're talking about a brand.
Right, she's
on
not
Twitter.
Louise Linton. She's classier than that.
Yeah, but she says, you know, oh, I'm a photographer. And then she sort of says that her photography, her art, is that brands pay her to talk about their stuff. The husband's art is to paint hashtags on crappy hotel art, even though he doesn't even own a smartphone, right? So, you know,
his art, in a way, is to satirize Instagram influencers, right?
Yeah.
Which would have been a great fight for the couple to get into, but they never really quite do.
Yeah, there's a weird way in which the stuff the movie lightly plays, I wish were more foregrounded, and some of the foregrounded stuff I wish were in the background. Like, we actually get the resolution of her marriage in an offhand line in the background of the audio mix when the camera isn't even on her husband, about what's going on in their life. And I just wish some of that stuff was actually more to the fore in the second half.
Well, also, I think this is a pretty major flaw in the movie is that Ice Cube Jr., as I kept on thinking of him, because O'Shea Jackson is Ice Cube's son, and he looks so much like his dad, who he played in Straight Outta Compton, that
haunting.
I just kept thinking, is it 1991? Why is Ice Cube on screen? And he has sort of a similar
warmth. He looks so young,
Anyway, so O'Shea Jackson complimenting aside, that character should have gotten fed up with Ingrid. That is an important part of her moral growth, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the very first interaction they have, she's his tenant, she borrows his truck, this isn't giving away too much, it happens near the beginning, and she keeps it out all night, keeps him from going to a very important job event that he had to go to, returns it damaged, and continues to be his tenant. I mean, forget about a relationship with her. He should have just said, bitch, get out of my house.
Well, there's an interesting beat, again, they start to hint at without exploring, that she is actually quite adept at reshaping herself to be what he wants when she needs something from him, in a scene that I won't spoil. And that is another thing that they sort of started to explore and then stopped. The film has a lot of different irons in the fire, you know, and some of them it just kind of leaves there to melt instead of doing something with them.
That, for me, finally, is the issue of the movie, which is that if it's a study of a certain kind of sociopath, then you're fascinated by her and train your eyes on her and watch as her sociopathy plays out in the new context of social media and Instagram, or she's a stand-in for all of us. And the illness, you know, Isaac, as you put it, that we're all suffering from, which is, you know, faced with this choice of being at the center of a curated and highly displayed social media existence, or being a vicarious and slightly exiled slob on the fringes of "quote unquote," what is actually happening? It's like kind of that was a tough choice that it tried to make both ways, and that's where the movie went a little bit muddled. That said, I want to conclude the segment by going around the table, because I say definitely seek this movie out. Especially as a hugely accomplished first effort from the director. Do the panelists agree?
I think if we're doing Sound Opinions, where they have the buy it, stream it, trash it, that's their three-part rating scale. I'm stream it.
Yeah, I'm stream it too. I'm stream the first hour of it with some good snacks on hand. And if you get really disillusioned, it's fine. You got the best out of it already.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the movie is Ingrid Goes West. We would love to hear what you think about it at facebook.com/culturefest. And it stars Elizabeth Olsen and Aubrey Plaza. And as we all pointed out, O'Shea Jackson is wonderful in a supporting role. All right, moving on. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about business, of which we always have some, Dana, don't we? What do we have this week?
Indeed, we do. Our first piece of business is a very exciting one. As you all know, if you've been listening recently to the show, we are going to Toronto in September to the Toronto Film Festival to do a live show at the Toronto Reference Library. So the tickets went on sale last week, or rather went on get them free time on a given day last week, and they all sold out in 90 minutes, which is incredible. And we're very flattered. So thanks to everyone who got a free ticket to the show. But if you missed it, there is still one way to do the show, which is to get a ticket to the cocktail after party at a nearby location. There are about 30 of those left, and that ticket will also, of course, get you into the live podcast. So if you want to try to go for one of those cocktail after party tickets for the live Toronto show on September 13th at 7 p.m. at the Toronto Reference Library, go to slate.com/live for more info. Next, our Slate podcast pick of the week is our beloved Hit Parade, Chris Malenfi's brilliant podcast about the stories behind chart-topping hits. Some of the ones he's done so far include the week that the Beatles swept the entire Billboard Top 5, the surprising history of UB40's Red Red Wine, that was his very first one, and it was fabulous, even if you hate that song, and the rise and fall of the Charity mega single, which we've talked a little bit about with Chris on this podcast. One of my favorite episodes, and the one that really made me fall in love with Hit Parade for the first time, was a show about Elton John and George Michael and some parallel developments in their careers. So you can listen to Hit Parade on the Culture Gabfest feed, wherever you get your podcasts. And just by way of personal endorsement, somebody wrote me, I believe this was on Twitter, somebody wrote me saying, yeah, thank you so much for introducing us to Hit Parade through your Gabfest feed. You have a good podcast, but he has a great podcast. And I was happy to be backhandedly complimented.
That's quite a hard backhand.
It's like a Federer's backhand drive.
Yeah. Yeah, right to the face. Yeah.
Phil Chris should be happy, although he loves our show, so maybe he'll have some pity, throw us some love. In Slate Plus today, if you have a Slate Plus subscription, you will get to hear us talk about Stephen's recent piece in The Guardian about neoliberalism. So to hear extra segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, you can sign up for Slate Plus, which is the membership program for Slate Magazine, where fans of our podcast can help support us. If you like this show and find it valuable, joining Slate Plus is a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing these shows. And of course, in return, you get extended ad-free versions of these shows and a ton of other great benefits. So if you want to support the Culture Gabfest and the rest of the work we do at Slate, please come to slate.com/Culture Plus, that's one word, Culture Plus, and join Slate Plus today. Steve, I understand you also have a bit of business before we get back to the show.
I do. Thank you, Dana. Very quickly, for those of you who know me only as the pompous git on this podcast, you'll be surprised to know that in my other life, I enact the part of an even more pompous git. And in that capacity, I'm giving a lecture or talk at Ohio State University on September 29th, Friday, September 29th. I do sort of know what I'm talking about. It's a grab bag of all of my hobby horses. I'm talking about neoliberalism, which we'll talk about on the Slate Plus thing, and the American experience, like specifically what's an American expression of this highly abstract concept that appears to be ruling our lives. So anyway, I think it's going to be an interesting and fun talk. So if you want to come, that'd be great.
Cool. All right. Well, what do we got next on the show, Stephen?
All right, moving on. Rick and Morty follows the adventures of Rick Sanchez, a zany scientist who takes his 14-year-old grandson on insane parallel dimension adventures. I hardly know how to describe it. It's H.P. Lovecraft meets Bob's Burgers meets String Theory meets A Fistful of Peyote. I just don't know. My daughter loves it. I'm starting to love it. Best thing to do here, I think, is to listen to a clip.
You know what? You're going to land on your feet, Jer. Some company out there is going to think they're lucky stars they hired my little brother.
Who the f*** are you?
My goofy brother, Steve? He's been living here almost a year now. Are you losing your mind?
Hey, someone's been spending too much time around glowing rocks, am I right?
Would everybody just relax for a second? There's no such thing as an Uncle Steve. That is an alien parasite.
But I've known him my whole life.
No, you haven't, Jerry. These telepathic little bastards, they embed themselves in memories, and then they use those to multiply and spread out and take over planets. It's disgusting.
Steve wasn't real?
He's a real piece of shit. This is a big one. Somebody probably tracked it in last week on the bottom of their shoe or on a piece of alien fruit.
Someone?
Get off the high road, Summer. We all got pink eye because you won't stop texting on the toilet.
But Uncle Steve taught me how to ride a bike.
No, Steve put that memory in your brain so we could live in your house, eat your food, and multiply. We could be infested with these things, so we gotta keep an eye out for any zany, wacky characters that pop up.
Ooh-wee! Whatever you want, Rick, we're here to help.
Thanks, Mr. Poopy Butthole. I always could count on you.
All right, Isaac.
That's from the episode Total Recall.
So as the resident completist of Rick and Morty, you have to retroactively set up a little bit what was going on in that clip so people don't just take away, oh, zany stuff happens on the show.
Oh, boy. Yeah, so that's from an episode called Total Recall. Actually, the setup is explained in that clip, which is that there are these memory parasites that are infesting this family with memories that involve wacky, heartwarming adventures. And every time they go to one of these flashbacks, which is fake, they're all fake flashbacks, a new wacky character sort of incepts within it and shows up in their house. That family specifically is an incredibly dysfunctional, codependent one, where you have Rick, the grandfather, who's the most brilliant man in any universe, but he's also this like horrible sociopathic alcoholic. And then you have his daughter, Beth, also an alcoholic, and a veterinary surgeon who specializes in horses. And she's married to a kind of totally useless man named Jerry, played by Chris Parnell from SNL and Archer and all sorts of other TV shows. And then they have two kids, Summer, who's like a high school popular girl, and Morty, who is a 14-year-old, kind of very normal, insecure 14-year-old. And Rick kind of press gangs Morty into being his sidekick for these increasingly traumatizing and violent and surreal adventures throughout space and time.
It seems worth noting as well, since we're talking about who's voicing what, that the co-creator of the show, Justin Roiland, does the two main voices, both Rick and Morty, which is sort of stunning when you start looking at the credits because they're wildly different voices and they take up 90% of the episode. So I'm just imagining that the taping sessions are going to be really hard on the voice of Justin Roiland, who co-created the show with Dan Harmon of Community.
Yeah, and I think Dan Harmon's involvement sort of is the other big story here. Dan Harmon, I mean, this is very much like Community on hallucinogens and steroids and speed all at the same time, right? I mean, it's playing around with TV tropes the way the Community did, but in a much more extreme way. It has a very similar kind of every moment sort of has multiple tones going on at once, and you're never sure quite how sincere it's being. And, you know, it has a lot of the same thematic concerns that Harmon is circling in Community. Although I actually think Rick and Morty, in part because it's fewer episodes per season, is probably more consistent, but certainly a more extreme version of that vision.
Mm. Dana, I'm really curious to know whether you liked it. I mean, had you encountered it before, and what was your reaction to it?
I hadn't encountered it before. I sort of resist Adult Swim in general, and I think it's because I think that Adult Swim is still at where it was at, I don't know, 10 years ago or something. I don't even know how long that programming block has existed, but I sort of associate it with this mid-aughts sort of like jaunty misogyny, you know, like there was always this sort of heavy stream of like cruel, aggressive, often aggressive towards women or maybe homophobic, you know, that sort of strain of like nihilistic boy humor on Adult Swim that kind of put me off. And I have to admit that there are slight glints of that in this show that I see from time to time. I can't get into what they are without, I guess, revealing spoilers if that means anything for this show. But for example, there's an episode where Morty, who's obsessed with a girl at his school named Jessica, who he's in love with, begs his genius grandfather to create a love potion so she'll fall in love with him. And he does. That ends up backfiring in a hilarious way where the love potion spreads because the love object has the flu. And soon the whole world is erotically obsessed with this 14-year-old nerd named Morty. And that's all great. But there's a moment late in that episode where the grandpa, Rick, says something like, "I made you your roofie," or something like that. There's like this joke about roofieing that kind of, you know, brought me up short a bit. But these are small complaints in general. I think the show is actually really generous spirited. And the very moment that you think it is taking some sort of turn that's just simply cruel or nihilistic, there's like a glint of humanity that comes out. That said, I couldn't stop watching it. It's really brilliantly written. But there's like an ugliness to the animation and a kind of shock value to, you know, there's just a lot of like gross monsters and planets that look like hairy testicles. And you really sort of have to have the stomach for some very fast moving and mean humor. I also kind of got sick of the voice characterization of Rick having to belch all the time. I was always dreading his next mid-dialogue belch. But that said, yeah, more than I would send people to Ingrid Goes West, the first topic we talked about today, I would send people to Rick and Morty, even if they are resistant to that Adult Swim brand of humor, because there's something more going on there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a couple of different things. One is that the show is brilliant. It's brilliantly written. It's building on this template, you know, that's now approaching 30 years old of The Simpsons as iterated out by The Family Guy up through Bob's Burgers or whatever. And people want to build on this template of a sort of normal family somehow iterating out into, you know, amazingly, like, weirdly fanciful directions upon which you can graft this, like, setup punchline, setup punchline, setup punchline. It's a delivery system for writers who know how to produce that. And those have proliferated over the last 30 years as this has become a standard career path, you know, for young smarty farties out in Hollywood. And so it's good. It's going to be good. And there's going to be five more like them if we continue doing this podcast over the next 10 years that we'll be obliged to talk about. And they'll all be really good. And they'll all be sharp. They'll all have this kind of edge to them. They'll be generated overwhelmingly by boys in writers' rooms. And
wait, Steven Universe being an exception, one that's generated by a woman, but that I think has something in common with it.
Exactly. That was where I was going to go, in fact. So as much as this comes out of that tradition, which I really freaking admire, I want to be completely clear. I mean, I love Bob's Burgers. Without trying to do too much or anything too new, they did something kind of wonderful on Bob's Burgers. I admire this. This is brilliant. I see why my daughter loves it. It really isn't for me. Whereas when I watch the other show that she loves, Steven Universe, I feel like I'm watching something that's from a completely different genealogy and sensibility in a way. And it doesn't feel constrained by this a kind of studied and slightly cruel anti-humanist sensibility that then is supposed to make you grateful for the glimpse of humanity or tenderness that comes in right at the end, right? Like Steven Universe actually is humane and is humanist and does kind of love the world and the characters in it. Whereas this one, just, it has a scabrousness that is as a you know, kind of perma boy who once felt and thought in those terms, I've kind of lost as I've hit middle age. So when I say that it doesn't hit my target, I'm not in any way criticizing it, because it is clearly brilliant. I mean, the kind of weird string theory one where Rick encounters all possible Ricks is fucking genius. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. So I'm not in any way trying to dissuade anyone from watching it. I'm only encountering my own feelings publicly about why it no longer connects with someone like me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, scabrous is really a good word for that assaultive quality that it has. But I mean, just to give you an idea of how deep the rabbit holes go, that episode you saw about the multiple Ricks goes on to, and I'm sure Isaac knows more about this than me, but it goes on to a whole story arc about the different universe of possible Ricks interacting with each other, trying to kill each other, fighting with each other, waging war. It's a really incredible breadth of vision.
It's amazing.
For, yeah.
Yeah, they're like a sort of United Nations of the dimensions, right? That exists to regulate all of the Ricks, because in every universe Rick appears, he's the smartest person in it and is also a crazy alcoholic and, you know, all sorts of other things. And so it sort of exists to regulate the Ricks. And then, of course, they're constantly always at war with each other because Rick can't help but be at war with himself. And it is actually, I think, I do not think that it is quite as schematic. I actually totally understand your criticism, Stephen. I think this season, the latest season, which is by far the show's darkest and least humanist, has been more difficult for me to watch than the other two. I think that it is less schematic about, like, you know, let's get all this darkness and then have the heartwarming beat at the end. Although that often does happen because Harmon is obsessed with, you know, story structure, and that's a very satisfying beat to have. I think it is also that there is a real wrestling, and maybe this is just because I've read a lot of interviews with Harmon or something, but there is this real wrestling with one's own sort of misanthropy and humanism. And the show tries to contain both of those at the same time and let them wrestle with each other, mm-hmm. which is what I find really interesting. Mm-hmm. The reason why I would say that Rick and Morty is actually the best of the post-Golden Age Simpsons-like TV shows, and in fact better than The Simpsons has been for a long time, is that there's mm-hmm. often multi-layered density. There's many different things going on often at any one moment, and they don't all agree with each other. They're actually kind of in tension with one another, and I find that very those contradictions very energizing. And I find that in this show, it's very difficult to keep that from just folding into tonal incoherence. And I think the show does a really mm-hmm. good job when it's at its best. There's a couple episodes where it doesn't quite do that, but the show does a really good job of kind of keeping that aloft.
I just want to end with a question because I'm curious. I don't know the answer, and I'd love to hear both of you speak to it. The internally self-referential meta, you know, kind of glass vacuum tube in which a lot of very smart and knowing pop culture takes place. Every now and then, do you feel a little oxygen deprived? I feel as though we're at the end of the possibilities generated by that, that idea that something can be made by people whose primary experience is pop culture for people whose primary experience is pop culture. Is that getting a little airless for you? Because it is for me.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, this to me goes back to our conversation about Billy Eichner, the Man on the Street show, right? That you and I couldn't stand and Julia finds utterly hilarious. It's a very different world, obviously, than the world of Rick and Morty or any of these cartoon shows we're talking about. But it is kind of both in the satirical loop of mocking our obsession with celebrity and trapping us inside of that loop. I don't know. What about you, Isaac? Is that completely tapped out?
I think that this show takes it about as far as you can. Right. I mean, you know, that Total Recall episode, for example, is kind of a parody of The Thing. And then they have Keith David as one of the voices in that episode, voicing a character named Reverse Giraffe, who has a tiny neck and arms. And but I think they mine it and go about as far into that as is possible. And I hope we start to maybe turn that around and build on other things. But I'm very happy to see them do it. They do also have a quote in an episode that explores this, which is, "On one of our adventures, Rick and I basically destroyed the whole world. So we bailed on that reality and came to this one, because in this one, the world wasn't destroyed, and in this one, we were dead. So we came here, and we buried ourselves, and we took their place. And every morning, I eat breakfast 20 yards from my own rotting corpse. I'm better than your brother. I'm a version of your brother you can trust when he says, don't run. Nobody exists on purpose. Nobody belongs anywhere. Everybody's going to die. Come watch TV."
So I guess depending on whether that makes you laugh or sends a deep chill through your being, you can decide whether to see Rick and Morty.
It's meant to do both, right? All right, great segment. It's Rick and Morty. It's on Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network. We have mixed feelings, which means we want to hear what yours are. Facebook.com/culturefest. Okay, moving on. All right, well, this next segment, it's going to feel at first like we're all on the same peyote that we took in order to understand Rick and Morty. But let me begin by just reading the first paragraph of the article under discussion. "The same week that a statue of Robert E. Lee led to the death of an innocent woman in Charlottesville, Virginia, I watched him oink and squeal in a race for the fate of the country. Lee, this time, was a piglet, part of Dolly Parton's Dixie Stampede, a medieval times style dine-in attraction where 7 nights a week and at occasional weekend matinees, the South rises again." Let me welcome to the show Aisha Harris, a close friend of the program. You're a CFOP now, I believe. That's your current ranking at the Slate Culture Gabfest. Aisha Harris is a contributor to Slate, host of the Slate podcast Represent. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you. Yes, Dixie.
Aisha, you're going to have to walk me through this one slowly. I did not know that this restaurant existed. Tell me exactly what it is and what led you there.
Well, I didn't either. And I'm as I said in the piece, I'm a very casual fan of Dolly Parton. I, you know, love 9 to 5, both the song and the movie. And I enjoy some of her other songs.
She's karaokeable.
She's karaokeable. And she's also just really, like, I just admire her for like all of her like her business acumen, her artistry, her like her feminism. It's great. But then I was reminded, or I was informed of this dinner theater show that she has, and it's just up the road from Dollywood, which is in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. That's quite the name. And it's been running for 30 years, actually. So this is not new. Like, this has been around for 30 years.
And were you going to Dollywood anyway or driving to that part of the country? Or you made a specific trip to
this
go?
This is a trip because one of our wonderful colleagues at Slate reminded us that this existed. And it felt especially relevant considering all of the hubbub around the Confederate statues, the monuments coming down, everything happening in Charlottesville, and the fact that this show, in which the conceit is that when you buy your ticket, you can choose between the North or the South side, and you sit in this giant horseshoe theater. It seats like 1,100 people, and you basically get to cheer on for the North or the South side. And
you need to pick a side when you buy your ticket.
Yes, you have to pick a side. there's no middle ground. There's no neutral. And when they have like, it's medieval times, but there's also like some country fair type of stuff, a little bit of Cirque du Soleil. There's a pig race. There's lots of races, actually. And you have performers in the middle of the theater who are on either side, so North or South. So each game is like a competition. So there's a pig race. The pigs are named Robert E. Lee and
Abraham Lincoln,
Scarlett O'Hara, and the last one is Ulysses S. Grant.
The drunken pig.
Yes. and there's other races and there's other competitions. And then there's also this weird, like, weird history of, like, the settling of the West that includes Native Americans in the most weird, condescending, in a way. So it's a bizarre show. Plus there's food.
Which is served while you watch the
yes.
show.
An yes. entire, what is it, an entire rotisserie chicken?
An entire.
Some smoked pork loin.
Yes. Corn on the cob, vegetable soup, and what was the last thing? Oh, a biscuit. Oh, and then you get like a little pastry at the end. This is all for one person, per person. You get all of that per person.
And since you went to the show twice in one night, right? You sat on the Union side and the Confederate side, so you ate that meal or at least parts of it twice.
Yeah, I mean, I knew going in, I was like, okay, but there's no way I can do this twice in a row. So like, I picked at it each time, like enough to like satisfy myself before the next show. And the next show, I was like still too full, so I definitely
didn't. Okay, there's so much going on here that I need some sort of visual and auditory cues. What did it look and sound like as you entered and sat down for the show?
So in the post, we actually put a promo that included is little clips of Confederate dressed and Union dressed performers, some of them passing out corn on the cob on your plate. But I'm assuming Dolly, because it was posted by the Dolly Dixie Stampede original page on the YouTube, they took it down. So we replaced it with this audio and visual of, I think it's a different show or it's a show from a couple years later, because it doesn't look quite like the one that I was at, but you can hear a little bit of Dixie in it.
All right, let's listen to a clip just to get some sense of what the musical atmosphere of the Dixie Stampede is like.
Forward, ho!
I was really fascinated by that piece. And particularly about its ongoing theme of history and forgetting, you know, about like how we shape our, this is one way we shape our history, these monuments, of course, being another one, and the connections you draw between them. But I would love for you to talk about, since you sat on both sides, and you talk about this a bit in the article, kind of like, what does it mean? What does the South actually mean at this event? Or like, what does the North actually mean at this event?
Yeah. So I actually asked our lovely waitress, Jan, at the first show I went to. And then the first show I sat on the North side. And I was like, so like, what does the North and South mean? Like, what's the point? And she was just like, oh, it's just a friendly competition. It's the costumes. And so like the costumes are, so I should point out that the North and South, while they weren't dressed in the Confederate uniforms, like I saw in that original promo, and that might be at the Branson, Missouri location. There's another location too. I went to the Pigeon Forge one. This one, they weren't wearing full on uniforms, but they were wearing uniforms that were color-coded to the North and the South of the Civil War. So the North, they were wearing these like navy blue with a little bit of like yellow and white trim on them outfits. And then the South side was wearing the red and gray predominantly gray outfits. So, and she was just like, it's just friendly competition. And some people really love sitting on the north and some people really love sitting on the south. I was like, okay. and so the host, there's a host of the show and he rides in on horseback. He's wearing the full on like white, very beautifully white cowboy outfit. And he basically lays out the rules towards the beginning. He's like, all right, so the north, you think that the south side is like a bunch of like, he uses like some very hokey, like,
wasn't it flat-headed?
Yeah, flat-headed.
Well, interesting, narrow-minded came in there, which is the closest, it seemed to me, that anyone even came to alluding to the issue of slavery in the entire evening, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, like, he implored each side to, like, think of them as, like, these terrible people. And then he's like, all right, there are going to be times when you're going to have to boo the other side and blah, blah, blah. And, like, the kids around me got really into that because, like, when you're a kid, like, of course you want to, like,
yeah,
participate in that stuff. And so, but then throughout the night, there was this weird, like, every once in a while, the South pretty much won most of the games. But, like, even when they won, sometimes they would let the North do a do-over. And so, like, they would do a game, like, I think they did the pig race twice. And so they had, like, actually 8 pigs racing as opposed to 4. Because there was 4 for the first race. And then they're like, oh, well, we'll give the North another chance. And, like, so then they got another chance. And I think they still lost in at least one of the games. It was just weird, this weird competition that, like, doesn't frame it specifically as a civil war, but obviously with the names of the pigs and then the North versus South and the colors and then the Northerners only, Southerners only bathroom stalls, which I was appalled to see. it was clearly like, it was not just a celebration, quote unquote, of Southern culture. It was a very much, because you can't separate Southern culture from the history of slavery. I don't think you can. So it was still there. Like, those elements were still there.
It's crazy. It's like a totally defanged reenactment of the Civil War. Yeah. Well, here's a question about authenticity. So you say that they're not wearing actual Confederate and Union uniforms. They're wearing these kind of costumes that suggest them. But you also mentioned that one of the contests that happened in both sessions was this flag passing contest where each side is supposed to pass a bunch of flags as quickly as possible to the other side and whoever does it wins.
Yeah.
Are those actual Confederate and Union flags?
No, no. They have, like, the standard Dixie with the Dixie Stampede logo on it, like, just one flag, and that each side had the same color flag. And they were also, like, trying to sell them to everyone.
Right. So there's another gesture of defanging right there, right? Like,
yeah.
Let's all wave around flags signifying the Civil War, but God forbid they be the actual flags that carry that history with them.
Exactly, yes. And there were hints of, like, there is one moment where they have this Southern Belle dance number, where there's just a bunch of women in these Scarlett O'Hara dresses that also, like, light up like Christmas lights. There's a lot of Christmas lights in this show. They also have a Christmas show, so I'm sure they use them for both. But while they're dancing, like, there's also a screen that's above, like, the whole shebang, and it projects different images. Like, sometimes it was, like, horses, and sometimes it was, like, the Statue of Liberty. But during this number, I remember there being a actual, like, plantation. Like a house that looked like a plantation, like, up there. So,
right. So there's lots of kind of antebellum nostalgia, but completely stripped of any racial element whatsoever.
Right. So it's just sort of like, oh, but this is just such a large, beautiful house on a beautiful plot of land. I mean,
exactly.
That's kind of the, yeah, all right. The other thing that was quite odd to me was how much sort of Wild West iconography, which I know grows out of the Civil War, right? Like, the Western, you know, comes out of that. But I was very, it seemed very weird to me that so much of it was, like, about cowboys.
Well, see, to me, I mean, granted, then you have that whole other thing with Native Americans and ignoring that, but
the photo of which in your article really must be seen to be believed, because they look like
the blacklit Native Americans that look like they came from Spencer's.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like had it just been about seeing, like, a country rodeo, like, I like country music, I enjoy it. Rodeos can be fun. I imagine I've never been to one, but, like, this is probably the closest I'll ever get to going to a rodeo. But because they threw in the competition and those Civil War moments, I was like, you can't just pretend that this is just about the Wild West. Like, and that was my problem. And I really hope they tweak it so that they just get rid of all that.
I mean, it's so funny and weird that it's impossible not to talk about it in a kind of comic mode. But I mean, the fact that this is actually sort of the education in what the Civil War was that a lot of kids are having when they go to this experience is pretty insidious and freaky.
We've talked around it, so I'll go directly there. I mean, it's what is going on vis-a-vis the Confederate memorials is, and the character of the protests against their removal has to do with not just the original sin of slavery and the compounded original sin of the Civil War, the secession and the Civil War, and then the triply compounded original sin of remembering the legacy of the Civil War wrong and allowing the side that lost to form its own cultural memory in a way that we never would have let and did not let the Nazis do. You know, the Germans do after a total defeat in World War II.
And they didn't let themselves do. I mean, you know, it seems like they did a better job at fighting off that kind of nostalgia than we have.
Oh, yeah.
And have devoted themselves, you know, nose to tail in Germany towards the right kind of cultural memory in order to prevent a repeat, right? So is this how to look at this? I mean, is one way to look at it as a kind of sterilization via kitsch that's so silly that the past becomes meaningless in a way that we can transcend it, which is an optimism I don't feel and I doubt you do too, but just as one possible reaction? Or is it that it's really deeply offensive and the wrong kind of historical memory? Or was that not quite the right dialectic? Is that not what you walked away thinking the choice might be?
I don't find it. I mean, save from the Native American section, which was just really like they literally said that the Native Americans were steeped in legend and magic and mystery, which is like a whole other long problem of defining and understanding what Native Americans are and mean to this country. I don't think it's not deeply offensive. I'm just concerned. I think it's the former of what you said. I'm concerned because it is just one aspect of many. Like it's a small part of a greater whole of our country, like making light of the past. And I think it contributes to allowing people to think of it as something that is in the past, and something that is linked to quote unquote heritage when it's really not. And I also think that considering that there are so many, this is a family show, like 90% of the people I saw there were with kids. And I kind of knowing our public education system and understanding our history books and what we allow our kids to read, I'm concerned that it's just contributing to the continued ignorance of the South to admit that the South, the Civil War was about slavery. Like it was.
Right. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket of what's out there, but it's a bad drop in a bad bucket, and it's worthy of being exposed to the light. So I'm glad you wrote this.
And I think just going through Dolly and like most of I've gotten tons of hate mail. You guys can keep sending it. I'm not reading it. So keep writing me those, you know, 5-paragraph long emails if you want. I'm not reading them. But a lot of the tweets and whatever have been like, oh, but how dare you attack Dolly? I mean, I also cross over into the Dolly stands. Like anytime you have someone who has huge fans, you're going to deal with that. But they're like, she's done more good for the country and for Tennessee than you ever will. It's like, well, Dolly can both do really great things and also have this really unfortunate show.
Right.
and I'm not asking her to get rid of it. I just think that it should do better. And I think the fact that they took the promo video down shows a sign that maybe, hopefully, they're reconsidering the show and maybe don't want to name it Dixie anymore.
Right.
So we'll see.
All right. Well, it's an amazing piece. People should read it. Dolly Parton's Dixie Stampede, Springtime for the Confederacy, a wonderful allusion to Springtime for Hitler, the song from the producers. Aisha Harris, thank you so much for coming back on the show and discussing the piece.
Thank you.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, my endorsement is maybe a little bit more like a cocktail chatter a la Political Gabfest this week because it's not a thing. In fact, it's the absence of a thing. This is somewhat inspired by having seen Ingrid Goes West and somewhat inspired by a conversation I had the night before. And well, I'll just tell the story. So the endorsement is essentially to find some way to get off social media and away from the news for whatever period of time is useful to you in your life. And I know that sounds like I'm the lifestyle guru, Taylor Sloan, Elizabeth Olsen character, and I in no way have this mastered at all. But I was having a conversation with love of my life the other day about just how completely bulldozed we feel by media. He's not even a social media person at all. He's virtually never on it. I, as a lot of my listeners probably know, I'm a sometime Twitter addict, but I take weekend breaks from it. But for whatever reason, I was just feeling like, this is just insane. Like, the entire country is becoming the puppet of just this orange clown who tells us every day what we have to talk about and worry about and be scared about and do. And I was just really resentful and angry and exhausted by it. So we were just talking about strategies of how to manage this. And I was saying, I wonder if it would be possible for me to take a whole week off. I mean, I'm a journalist, maybe not a political journalist, but I sort of have to look at the news. Anyway, all of that happened on Sunday. On Monday, I happened to have a very busy day where I had a deadline that I had put off way too long and basically couldn't look at any social media or news and just had to write like a maniac for the first 6 hours of the day, then run off and see Ingrid Goes West, various other things. And at the end of the day, I realized, oh, I didn't go online at all today. I didn't look at a single headline. I didn't read the news. I didn't go on Twitter. I didn't do anything. Then I saw this movie that makes Instagram look like some sort of soul-stealing horror. And I figured, let's just keep the trend going. So I got through the whole day and went to bed without having ever done any of that. And I'm not going to say that I was happy and peaceful and calm and radiating waves of contentment on that day, but I got a lot done. And it was sort of nice to just not have to keep up and not know. I mean, granted, the next day I had to get ready for this show and had to consult some of those sources again. So I'm not issuing some sort of Zen directive about how we should all be sitting on cushions and not reading the news. It's really important to be engaged with what's happening in our country right now. But I just suggest that everybody sit down with someone they love and talk about this and think about what kind of management strategy they could come up with to retain A, their kind of sanity and sense of humor and ability to enjoy life, and B, just their projects that they care about. You know, just find a way to get back to a world where you can get up and work on something that you care about and instead of letting some orange clown tell you what to do. That's my endorsement.
I love it. Isaac, what do you have?
I have two for today. As listeners probably know, the U.S. Open, the fourth of the four tennis Grand Slam tournaments, is going on right now here in New York City in Queens. I am a tennis obsessive, as anyone who follows me on Twitter has to suffer through. But even if you are not, I have to recommend, it's an oldie but a goodie, the book Levels of the Game by John McPhee. It's a short book. It's like 160 pages. And it's just about this one tennis match between Arthur Ashe and Chuck Grebner in 1968 at the U.S. Open. And it takes this one match and it spirals from there into being about race in America in the 60s, about the transition from tennis being an amateur sport to a professional sport. It gives you a whole biography of Ashe up till that point. A lot of it's about Richmond, Virginia, which is much in the news today because of the all the Confederate monuments there, and is also where my whole family is from. And it's on a sentence by sentence level, just gorgeous, like impeccably written book. It started as a series of articles for The New Yorker, as many of McPhee's books do. And it's absolutely wonderful. If you like tennis, if you like David Foster Wallace, who borrowed from it pretty heavily in terms of his thinking about tennis, or just like really great essayistic writing, I just think it's a masterpiece. Levels of the Game by John McPhee. My second one is a book called The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. This year, after the election, I decided I'm going to give myself permission to read a lot of science fiction again. Something I find is a very sort of both comforting and allows me to explore the world in a different way. And for months, people were recommending this book to me. And in some perverse way, because they were all recommending it, I resisted it. And that was really stupid. It's a really beautifully written book. It's the first in a trilogy. And the world ends on the first page, and then the book follows three different women who are all sort of one of whom is living through that apocalyptic event, and the other two timelines are before it. And the prose is really beautiful, the way she sort of modulates the point of view strategy for each of those three plot lines and shapes the voice is really cunning. And anyone who likes Ursula Le Guin, you know, I think would dig it. And that's The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin.
Oh, wow. Okay. Reading list. I love it. Well, I'm going to add to it with something completely obvious, but nonetheless utterly compelling as far as I'm concerned. I now go once a year to a little out-of-the-way town in Maine and stare at the water for 1 week, sabbathing from modern life completely, watching porpoises and eagles, it's true. But the highlight of it is, in addition to the company, wonderful company, is I read a volume of the Elena Ferrante Neapolitan books. I am only on volume 2. Last year was the first year. I just read The Story of a New Name.
That's my favorite one.
Oh, Isaac, I am so heartened to hear you say that. Oh, absolutely. God, I can see why. I mean, I can't compare it to the successive ones, but it's just, without giving anything away, I mean, the first volume, she does so much work giving you the limits of the world of young girls growing up in a severely provincial and in some ways ruled by violence and custom of the wrong kind neighborhood. And she's built it up so fully and so totally and gets you so within that worldview that in volume 2, she starts to break the worldliness of the adults that they're, the consciousness of the worldly adults that they're going to become starts to break into their world in these poignant ways that are both so hopeful and so heartbreaking. And it's just so, it's tenderly, beautifully realized. It is shaping up to be one of the greatest works of literature I think I've ever read. I mean, one says this hesitantly about something whose author is still alive. I'm a firm believer in the author's death plus 50 years before you begin to make these huge, sweeping historical generalizations about their greatness. Fuck that. I don't care. Elena Ferrante is a goddamn genius. And by the way, Julia Turner, she utterly deserved her total anonymity. But I mean, if for some reason these books have escaped your bedside table, you're really, really doing yourself an enormous disservice. They easily go down as two of the best books I've ever read, and together the arc that she seems to be piecing together is so extraordinary. I can only imagine where it's going to go next. Elena Ferrante, get your ass to Elena Ferrante if it hasn't gone there already.
This is sort of a little bit John Swansburg's Cheers endorsement territory, because
I get
you
it.
Probably have two listeners who don't already know these books are great, but I still love the passion of your endorsement, and I love that you're saving them for your vacations. I want to take some ownership of that because of my whole Moby Dick in the Summers Only strategy.
Yes.
That finally got me through that book, but something
Absolutely.
About saving great literature for vacation, that's worthy of endorsing in itself.
I totally agree.
And let me just quickly say, I only just discovered a Swedish indie pop band. You can't find them on Spotify. And apparently they're not even on iTunes, but I love them. And I want anyone out there who knows them to tell me why they're so fucking hard to track down. They're called either Eggstone or...
I wish Jody Rosen were here right now.
It's either Eggstone. It's one word. Eggstone. So it's Eggstone, but either it's kind of like Eggstone.
Is it
or
a stone made of an egg, or is it the tone of
go.
Eggs?
Thank you, Dan. Yes, duck bunny. I don't know. Anyway, it's a Wittgensteinian riddle, but they're also a fucking awesome Swedish pop band. Go ahead, have at me. I am the fool that you thought I was.
Every Steve in every alternate universe loves Swedish
yes,
pop band.
Yep. Converged into one and coughed up this furball of an endorsement. I don't care. I fucking love their music. Tell me all about them if you know anything about them. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steven.
Isaac, you are you're close to achieving supreme friend of the program or SFOP status. A total pleasure to have you back on.
Thank you so much, Steven.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page at slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. He's our Rick Sanchez. The Culture Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. There's an entire roster of really great shows at panoply.fm. You should definitely check them out. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Isaac Butler and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.